For the second time in a month, a tentative deal to end Pennsylvania's five-month-long budget impasse has fallen apart. I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. As WHYY's Kevin McCrory reports, the focus has turned to rank-and-file Republicans in the State House.
Governor Tom Wolf and Republican legislative leaders came to an agreement last week that would provide a historic boost to public education funding by broadening what's covered by Pennsylvania's sales tax. Also key to the deal, leaders agreed to allow wine to be sold in supermarkets and came up with a pension compromise that would call on new state employees, including teachers, to share some of the risk in their retirement plans. The tentative deal, though, came off the wheel Saturday when it became clear that House Republican leaders couldn't corral the votes for the pact. In a way, the larger budget negotiations have devolved into a debate about haircuts.
They want tax haircuts. So if I'm a family that has four kids, I'm not paying tax on haircuts.
Fred Keller is a House Republican from central Pennsylvania. Included on the tentative list of new items to be taxed are personal services like haircuts, manicures, and pedicures.
Why does state government consistently have an appetite to spend more and take more of your money above the rate of inflation, percentage-wise, what you're going to see in your pay?
But here's where there's sharp divisions within the Republican caucus. Many southeastern members of the GOP, like Montgomery County's Kate Harper, are ready to sign off on the framework agreement.
I would not be happy if the exemptions that we were taking away included food and other necessities, but they aren't. And I think that people can handle a 6% tax on a haircut. I just do.
Despite Harper's appeal, a budget bill is being advanced in the House that slashes the education spending agreed to by Wolf and Republican legislative leaders. This has left education advocates, including Donna Cooper of Public Citizens for Children and Youth, flabbergasted. Districts across the state have been operating without state money all school year, and many will soon run out of cash.
Obstinance on the part of the House Republicans is causing a fiscal crisis at the local government level that is soon to be unacceptable when children won't be able to go to school.
For WHYY News, I'm Kevin McCrory.
First responders gathered in Yardley, Bucks County today to demand that Congress keep paying medical bills for firefighters, paramedics, and police officers injured on 9/11. WHYY's Tom McDonald reports that money's running out to care for those with lingering illnesses.
Retired New York City firefighter Brian McGuire now lives in Bucks County, and since responding on 9/11, he suffers respiratory and gastrointestinal problems. He now has sleep apnea and has battled mental health issues. He says funding to care for first responders like him runs out unless Congress acts.
Without this reauthorization bill being passed by Congress, over 70,000 responders and survivors will lose necessary treatment and medical monitoring needed to survive.
Ellen Saracini's husband was one of the pilots of United Airlines Flight 175, which was hijacked and crashed into the World Trade Center. She says it shouldn't be this difficult to pay to care for those who fought to save lives on 9/11.
We have to remember and we have to honor the valor of all of our first responders. They were there for us and they will continue to be there for us whenever they are needed.
Philadelphia Firefighters Union head Andrew Thomas says his members are paying a heavy price for volunteering on September 11th.
25% of the members that went up there have an illness or cancer-related, and we know of one death.
Bucks County Congressman Mike Fitzpatrick says he's pushing for a reauthorization of the bill to care for the first responders as early as this week because a major sticking point has been overcome.
We believe that we've identified sufficient mechanisms to fully fund the $4 billion requirement of the reauthorization.
Fitzpatrick says if approved this time, the law would promise to cover first responders for the rest of their lives and not need to be renewed. I'm Tom McDonald, WHYY News.
In his speech last night from the Oval Office, President Barack Obama called the deadly San Bernardino shootings, quote, an act of terrorism designed to kill innocent people. NewsWorks blogger Solomon Jones says there's no doubt the president is right about that. He says he's less sure about the plan to go after ISIS.
Though President Obama said there's no evidence to indicate that their actions were directed by terrorists abroad, he tied their ideology to that of ISIS, saying the couple had embraced a perverted interpretation of Islam that calls for war against America and the West. Obama outlined a four-pronged strategy to defeat the terror group. It included military action, training and equipping Syrian and Iraqi forces, working with allies, including Muslims, to defeat ISIS, and seeking a political solution to the Syrian civil war. I don't agree completely with that strategy, because terrorism, to paraphrase the president, is a cancer that has no immediate cure. We can't control it by restricting the legal flow of guns, because the purveyors of terror aren't interested in legalities. And while some, including Liberty University President Jerry Falwell Jr., have encouraged law-abiding citizens to acquire concealed gun carry permits to fight terrorism, that's not the answer either. Because while you can kill an individual, you can't kill an idea. If ideas died with people, America would have defeated modern-day terror by killing Al-Qaeda founder Osama bin Laden. But ending terrorism isn't just about killing people. It's about defeating ideas. And creating an America that's safe from terrorism means standing for the principles we claim to hold dear. If we believe in the cause of freedom, then we must support it unabashedly. That means standing for freedom even when it's uncomfortable. It means knowing that some countries will not embrace democracy. It means acknowledging that not all Muslims are responsible for the actions of terrorists. It means realizing we're not always right. We must acknowledge the fact that securing our own economic advancement while paying lip service to the poverty of others does not create a safer world. It creates a more dangerous one. Because when lack of opportunity crushes young people's dreams, it's easy to convince them to die for even a false promise of freedom. Stopping our enemies from recruiting the hopeless requires more than a military response. We must also seek to win victory through ideas. We win when independence is more than a declaration, when freedom rings in the lives of the downtrodden, and when democracy is more than a theory. Only then will we convince young people of the American ideal that it is better to live for freedom than to die for it. I'm Solomon Jones.
Solomon Jones writes the Philly Experiment blog on Newsworks.org. Many cities used to have to plan for growth, but several Pennsylvania cities now face shrinking populations. It doesn't mean they get to stop planning. In fact, for some, it's a reason to start. For Keystone Crossroads, Rachel McDevitt takes us to one Pennsylvania city where leaders hope its first comprehensive plan is the key to its revitalization.
Okay, so this is State Street, which is the main street in downtown Erie. This is kind of ground zero, which is our local park.
Director of Community and Economic Development for the City of Erie, Kim Green, says the city on the lake is trying to right-size itself. It once held 140,000 people, but now its population is hovering around 100,000. So how can the city serve the needs of remaining residents and hold on to them? By implementing its first-ever comprehensive plan. Erie is the fourth largest city in the state, but it is among the last of the top 15 to catch up to the comprehensive plan bandwagon. It's not required. Under the Pennsylvania Municipalities Planning Code, only counties need to come up with a comprehensive plan. Erie officials are hoping their plan will set the long-term strategy for retaining young people, attracting businesses to the downtown, and dealing with its 4,000 vacant and abandoned properties. Greenpoint points these out as she drives into Erie's East Bayfront neighborhood.
It's almost like a smile with missing teeth because...
Jeremy Blazer with the Bayfront East Side Task Force is hoping the broad vision of the comprehensive plan will also help the East Bayfront.
If somebody gets shot at 8th and Parade, that's out of my neighborhood, but that doesn't help me find homeowners, help find renters, make people feel safe in our neighborhood because the perception is it's only two blocks away.
Blazer's task force partners with local businesses to help neighbors with home improvement and make the area more appealing and safe. Public-private partnerships like that are heavily emphasized in drafts of the comprehensive plan. They will have to play a big role in revitalization, says Green, because the city can't save itself on the backs of its taxpayers.
I mean, Erie is one of those cities that has 40-some percent that are nonprofits that aren't even contributing to the tax base. And so what's left is a lot of rentals, and we do have a lot of poverty, a lot of lower income people, and those folks cannot bear the brunt of the cost to improve the city.
What is that cost? Erie hired consulting firm CZB to lay out several options, and each comes with a different projected outcome based on the level of investment. The firm says with no added investments built into Erie's current annual operating budget of about $70 million, Erie will continue to lose population and tax revenue while gaining blight and poverty over the next 10 years, and that would put the city on a level with Camden, New Jersey. If the city spends $50 million over the next 10 years to clean up a few key neighborhoods with targeted demolitions of blighted properties and general beautification, the firm says Erie would still deteriorate to the level of Flint, Michigan. $100 million could make Erie look like Youngstown, Ohio.
You can't really sit back and spend 10 years studying, well, who else has done something like this, and how do we mitigate every risk? You sort of have to do things.
That's CZB consultant Peter Lombardi. He says if Erie actually wants to turn itself around, it will have to take risks and pay up. $200 million to be as successful as Pittsburgh, $300 million to be like Chattanooga, Tennessee. That kind of money will go to big changes, like a bike lane system, an innovation corridor for new businesses, and a dramatic reconnection of Lake Erie's bayfront to the downtown. Like many Pennsylvania cities, a highway is cutting off access between the downtown and the waterfront. The consultants and local planners say these projects would be transformational for Erie, but leaders have to follow through. Kathy Rosdick is the director of planning for Erie County. She says while a comprehensive plan isn't technically binding, it won't do any good sitting on a shelf.
For me as a planner, it's actually more important than a legal document because it is your roadmap to progress and to become better than what you are today.
The final draft of the plan should be finished in January. The city might formally approve it by March. Then, after months and months of presentations and preparation, Erie can really get started. For Keystone Crossroads, I'm Rachel McDevitt.
Keystone Crossroads is a statewide public media collaboration focusing on Pennsylvania cities, their problems, and potential solutions. WHYY leads the partnership. Turning to this evening's headlines, a Pennsylvania House Republican budget plan will be taken up by the full chamber after a party-line vote in the House Appropriations Committee today for a Republican bill about an hour after a rival budget passed the Senate with votes from both parties. The $30.3 billion House Republican alternative increases education funding less than the $30.8 billion Senate-passed proposal would. The House Republican plan also would apply the state's personal income tax to lottery winnings. The House could vote on it as soon as tomorrow. The New Jersey State Senate passed a measure that could make guns able to be fired only by authorized users more prevalent in the state. The Senate voted today in favor of a bill requiring firearms retailers to sell personalized handguns, also known as smart guns, in the same manner as other handguns. Lawmakers say the new legislation could result in less gun violence if firearms can be limited to only authorized users. Opponents warn the government shouldn't mandate what retailers can sell. The bill now goes on to the State Assembly. 46 degrees, mostly clear skies at 619. You're listening to Newsworks tonight on WHYY. Tonight's call, partly cloudy, low overnight, a frosty 36 degrees. Still ahead.
The background noise of everything else that happens on this planet simply overwhelms the signature of the gravity waves.
Sifting through the noise to prove another Einstein prediction when Newsworks Tonight continues on WHYY.
New Jersey's Clean Energy Program proudly supports WHYY. New Jersey's Clean Energy Program, incentivizing businesses, local governments, schools, and residents to integrate energy-efficient and renewable technologies into their new construction projects, existing building upgrades, and new equipment installation. More information about modernizing in your home and business with support from New Jersey's Clean Energy Program at njcleanenergy.com/WHYY.
Star Restaurants supports WHYY. Star Restaurants holiday gift cards are available now at any Star Restaurant or online at starr-restaurant.com. Accepted at 32 restaurants in 5 cities, distinctive meals can be enjoyed at favorites like Park.
Support the programs you love and depend on this season. Plus, for every donation we receive through Sunday, December 13th, we'll donate a meal to someone in need. Visit WHYY.org to make your gift today.
Welcome back to NewsWorks Tonight. I'm Dave Heller. The European Space Agency intends to launch the LISA Pathfinder satellite from French Guiana in the near future. Joining us to lend gravity to this momentous occasion is Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. We're searching for gravity?
It's the intention of the European Space Agency to try to figure out a way to detect very, very, very feeble gravity waves that emanate from almost every kind of astronomical explosion or massive event.
Is this still theory dating back to Albert Einstein, or have we yet detected or proved that gravity comes in the form of waves?
We feel rather strongly that these waves do exist. There's no reason not to believe that they don't exist, considering that everything else about what Einstein predicted to be true has turned out to be true relative or related to gravity. But what we're discovering is that the background noise of everything else that happens on this planet simply overwhelms the signature of the gravity waves. So, what can we do? Can we step off the planet, figure out how to isolate a detector from every other kind of force, and then allow that detector to sense the effects of gravitational waves?
Derek, we have about 3 hours left, so have at it. Gravitational waves are ripples in space-time.
Right. So, Einstein's special theory of relativity said that, rather than seeing gravity as the classical force that we all know it as, a mass attracts objects, instead, what he proposed is that very, very massive objects distort the fabric of space-time. Now, it's very, very difficult to represent the fabric of space-time because the words themselves make it confusing. But the way it's typically seen or presented is take a large blanket, pull it out at all four corners so that it's nice and tight, and then sit into the center of that blanket a bowling ball. Well, the depression that we see in the blanket, of course, is caused by the mass. And you could easily interpret that the larger the mass, the bigger the depression. So, for example, the velocity of the moon in its path is compromised by the depth of the depression created by the mass of the Earth on space-time. And whenever an event happens in space-time, ripples of gravity are felt across the universe. But, again, they're very, very, very slight. So this is the intention of what's being worked on by ESA right now, is creating a platform in space where they plan to try to isolate every other kind of effect so that the gold and platinum cube detectors could be able to sense gravity waves.
With our time remaining, let's head out of doors and look for gravity waves and, oh yeah, planets and comets and suns and such.
We can still see those gorgeous planets in the pre-dawn sky. It's Jupiter, Mars, and Venus, and 6 a.m. is a great time to be out. It's still dark enough, and we can see them over in the east without any problem. But as we continue to look at how the skies are changing, not only do we find over in the late night sky in the evening all of the stars of the winter constellations, Orion, Taurus, Auriga the Charioteer, the Big Dog and the Small Dog, Canis Major, Canis Minor, and also Gemini, we're also seeing the sunset times are now at a dwell point where sunset sits at 4:35 p.m. for this entire week until next Monday when we gain an extra minute on the sunset time. In other words, sunsets are going to begin coming later and later next week. But our days are still losing sunlight, and that's on the morning side, where sunrises will continue to come later and later until early January.
Thanks, Derek.
My pleasure, Dave.
Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. He joins us each week at this time on NewsWorks Tonight. A new play is open in Philadelphia telling the story of those who don't want to have their stories told. From WHYY's Arts and Culture Desk, Peter Crimmins reports on the premiere of a play about lesbians in Senegal.
In Senegal, homosexuality is illegal. It does exist, under the radar. Playwright Emma Goydell traveled there in 2011 while in college as part of a study abroad program, and she discovered a network of women who, for their own safety, have to hide their relationships with other women.
Most of the women I was meeting had never considered
sharing stories about their lesbian identities and experiences with someone who wasn't Senegalese and in this community, because it's so difficult for closeted queer Senegalese women to be out in any kind of way.
Goydell, who was a lesbian herself, wrote a play called A Knee That Can Bend. It's a fictionalized version of her experiences. The story is about an American student doing sociological research on homosexuals in Senegal. But in the play, the line between academic study and personal relationships gets blurry.
All this stuff would just pour out of her, these little stories, these beautiful things. It was like she couldn't tell anyone else.
She thought she was confiding in you.
I know. But I'm in a position to turn those experiences into knowledge that could, I mean, not right away, but someday,
you
someday.
You used my sister.
No, no. I heard your sister.
What if she did not want to be heard?
Goydell insists this character is not her, but she did grapple with some of the issues in the play. She wrote an early version of this play as a straight documentary, using the women's stories but changing the names. Goydell performed that one-woman show while in Dakar as her thesis project, and never again. She returned to this subject for a fictional play because it presents a cross-cultural paradox. How can she have fallen in love with Senegalese culture while at the same time that culture denies her own sexual identity?
I came home and I just was so full of questions, and also I had had access to this incredible closeted community that so few people get to enter.
A Knee That Can Bend is produced by the Orbiter 3 Theater Collective, now running at Theater Exile in South Philadelphia. I'm Peter Crimmins, WHYY News.
And finally this evening, the Philadelphia Orchestra and solo pianist Daniel Trifonov have been nominated for a Grammy in the Best Classical Instrumental Solo category. This selection is from the album Rachmaninoff Variations by Trifonov and the Philadelphia Orchestra, conducted by Yannick Nezet-Séguin. It was nominated for Best Classical Instrumental Solo. Nezet-Séguin is also separately nominated in the Best Opera Recording category for conducting Mozart with the Chamber Orchestra of Europe. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yaakov and Kimberly Haas, with help today from Alex Lewis. Find us on iTunes or listen at newsworks.org. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight.
Do you know someone with mild to moderate Alzheimer's? A clinical trial is being conducted to evaluate the safety and effectiveness of a study drug for the treatment of symptoms of Alzheimer's disease. Qualified participants must be at least 50 years old and have a support person to attend study visits. Qualified participants receive study-related medical care, memory testing, and routine lab work. Details at 215-884-1700. 215-884-1700. The Clinical Trial Center supports WHYY.
Novelist Rick Moody and his wife were having an unpleasant stay at a hotel.
And at some point, Laurel, my wife, said, "We should review this hotel."
That became the inspiration for his new book, Hotels of America, told in short online reviews by a man who's proud to be one of the top reviewers on RateYourLodging.com. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Tonight at 7 on WHYY-FM. Newman University supports WHYY and encourages listeners who are looking to change life direction to discover the master's degree in pastoral clinical mental health counseling. The program can help prepare adults for professional licensure and roles in community counseling. Designed to integrate psychology and spirituality, this ecumenical program is open to people of all faith traditions. Details at newman.edu/WHYY. Newman University proudly supports WHYY.